Hello, everyone, and thanks again for tuning in to Captain Hunter's podcast. I truly appreciate you guys taking the time and the effort to tune in. For a number of weeks now, a couple more people have been tuning in, and I really, truly appreciate that. They have been giving me their feedback, and I want you to know that I hear your feedback, and I'm going to listen, particularly to my daughter, who wanted me to shorten up the intro music. Thought you guys would like a little relaxation time, but that's fine. So I'm going to listen to all that. Another episode in which we're going to talk about some very controversial topics. Today we're going to talk about disparity in sentencing. Is there truly a disparity in the sentencing when we talk about black males being sentenced disproportionately in comparison to white males? So the reason that I'm really want to delve into this is because as I listen to other podcasts and listen to new broadcasts and other forms of information, it's come to my attention that there's always this line of reasoning that goes out that says that black males are overrepresented in jail and prison populations. And so I really wanted to discuss why. Now, we'll get into the reasons why, but a little bit later as we go along. But I really wanted to delve into what's really going on and what can we really do to fix all this type of thing. Or is this even a problem, right? The mindset that I want to approach this from is if there is some type of racial animosity on the part of judges, prosecutors, then this certainly needs to be addressed. But if the problem is simply that black males are committing more crimes, which let's be honest, we probably are. If that's the case, then we need to fix that. We need to look at that, be honest about it, and fix it. So let's take a look at what we can in order to fix those types of things. So that's what we're going to do today. Let's take our time. I don't want to bore you guys with a bunch of statistics. I don't want to bore you guys with a bunch of reading. I want to try to make this as fluid and as fun as possible, but I do want to give you guys the information. This is more of an informational type of podcast, and I want to give you guys the information, but I don't want to bore you guys with stats. So just, once again, just let me know how I'm doing, what you guys like, what you guys think, and what you guys want to hear about. So let me just pause here for station identification, if I can. You're listening to Captain L. Hunter's podcast, Captain Hunter's podcast. This is your boy, Big L, coming at you again. I also want to mention LMH. Police training and consulting. We got a number of things coming up, some big things coming up now. This is the end of April 2019 when I'm recording this. Next month, we're looking at doing some big things in May and starting a recurring session of sessions for people who want to be promoted. Now, what's going to be happening is instead of me doing one-on-one, I'm still going to be available for one-on-one sessions, Skype sessions or one-on-one in-person sessions in order to train people for those who want to become police officers or for those who want to take a promotional test. I'm still available for those, but I decided to widen my scope and broaden the horizons and do more informational type of sessions. What we're gonna do is 4-hour sessions in which I meet with people, groups of individuals for 4 hours. We're gonna talk about some things, talk about how people get promoted, and just go over a number of subjects and topics that I think are very important. If from that 4-hour session, you gain enough information that you feel that you need in order to do well in the test, hey, that's great. If you would still like some more work, particularly with your oral presentation skills, once again, I will always be available for those things. So my email is hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com, hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com. I also have a second email address, hunterpolicetraining@gmail.com, hunterpolicetraining@gmail.com. I will be transitioning over to the hunterpolicetraining.com in a few weeks because it's just simpler. I mean, the website is hunterpolicetraining.com, so why not just have the email there as well? When I was setting all this up, yes, my sister-in-law did tell me just to keep everything one. I decided not to do it, but after going through this a number of times and reviewing some things, I decided it's time to make that switch and time to make that change. So I appreciate her and all of her hard work and her counsel and advice. So just hit me up there and we'll see what we can do. A number of big things are coming up. I got some firearms classes that will be coming up real soon. If you want to get your pistol permit, you know someone else who wants to get the pistol permit, hunterpolicetraining.com. That's the website to reach me at, so I can reach there, and I will be available very, very shortly. Other programs are going to be coming up, all within the line of police work, but it will be able to branch out into other topics and subjects. I will, once I have all the certifications and requirements, then I'll broadcast that, and I think it's going to be a very vital portion. Listen, I'm looking to do everything from soup to nuts and providing you all with the best content that you can get. Obviously, everyone knows about the podcast, you know about the blogs, that I'm doing on my website. Please read those, check them out, and let me know what you want to hear about, what you don't want to hear about, what you like, and what you don't like, what I need to do in order to fix this. I want this to go worldwide, and I want this at least to go to the United States. Worldwide, if possible, but at least in the United States, so we can talk about what's going on in our countries. We can make sure that our communities and our police officers are working hand in hand to solve the crimes and solve the problems that are plaguing any and all of our communities. And this is not just for the African-American community. This is for urban communities as well, Hispanic communities, Asian communities, any communities where obviously officers are working at. But we know that in this country, and we're going to tackle this head on, that there is a problem where the police and African-American community have continued to have this problem throughout our history. Other communities have had their problems in their headbutting, if you will, with the police departments. LGBTQ community had their issues, unions had their issues, but many of these other organizations and many of these other entities, their problems have not been continuous as the African-American presence in this country. So we want to look to do what we can to fix those things. So let's talk about what we got going on today. So that's my website. Please hit me up, follow up, and let me know what you think. And here we go. So disparities in sentencing. So we're just going to kind of shorten that up because I don't want to get tongue-tied. So is there a problem with prison sentencing? So I was reading some things, listening to some other podcasts, and they were always talking about these things. And I hate the fact that African-Americans continue to play what many would consider the race card. I don't like that when we think that there's always a problem with us and that we have to cater to us in some certain way, in some certain form or fashion, in order to gain the sympathy of the public or to gain the sympathy of our politicians. You ask any politician what's going on and, you know, what can we do to fix African American community? And it's always about prison reform. Their answer is about getting African Americans to work. And I hate being looked at as some type of redheaded stepchild who is less loved by the parents. I hate being in that position. I hate being one of those people who feels as if we're in some permanent sense of second-class citizenship. I think it's disgusting. I think it erodes the morale. It destroys the confidence of many African Americans as we seek to grow up and become members of our society. I hate that. I want to do something about that. Hence the reason for this podcast, in order for us to work in alignment and congruity with our police departments. But I also think that what the important thing is that African Americans need to be African Americans. We need to be adults. We need to be the adult in the room, as we often had throughout our history. Whether other people are not treating us badly or whether they're treating us fairly, we need to treat ourselves in the right vein of mind and right frame of thinking. Without that, it doesn't matter what other people think about us. You know, until we get this mindset that it doesn't matter what other people think about us, until we understand that it's what we think about ourselves, that is the most important thing. It's not how other people view me. It's how I view myself. It's how I think about myself. It's how I go about my own business. That's the issue. Obviously, we have to understand that as we go about our own daily business and our own daily lives and journeys, that we come across people who are not going to view us with that same light. They'll see a darker skinned male and think other things about him. They'll see a darker skinned female and think negative things about them. That's their issue, as far as I'm concerned. It's their issue. I refuse to be a victim. I refuse to be a victim in the way that I approach things. I refuse to be a victim in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Refuse to be a victim. I am a full-fledged American citizen, just like anyone else. So I deserve every right to be treated as such. So as we look at this sentencing, one thing, I'm going to be going through a number of different websites and a number of different articles, as I usually do, but I don't want to bore you. I'm just going to try to run through them briefly. One of the biggest things is it is very difficult to assess whether there is actually disparity in the sentencing. Many people will talk about it, but when they usually do, they're usually talking about federal studies in which this has been indicated. I'll get into that a little bit. But let me just start off with this letter, if you will, this report that was submitted to the United Nations. So the Sentencing Project, thesentencingproject.org, released a report to the United Nations on racial disparities in the U.S. criminal justice system. This was reported April 19, 2018. They talked about the soup to nuts of the criminal justice system. They talked about policing. They went back into 1968, talked about the Kerner commission, which I talked about in previous podcasts. So I talked about all that. So I really want to narrow down the scope of this podcast and the scope of this episode into the sentencing, because they talk about the soup to nuts in the beginning to the end, right? The policing, they talked about the arrest, they talked about the pretrial, they talked about, and part of the arrest, and they talked about Ferguson, the way that neighborhoods are policed, they talked about the disadvantaged neighborhoods, things like that. That was all encompassed in their policing. And they talked about the pretrial before the actual trial takes place, and they talked about how poverty and the bail system are intertwined, and if you have less access to money, the more likely you are to sit behind bars, things like that. So they talked about the pretrial. So they talked about policing, pretrial. The third phase that they talked about was the sentencing. And this is what I really want to focus in on for this particular episode. And it says, in this sentencingproject.org, the report to the United Nations, under C, sentencing, and I'll read a little bit of this. Although African-Americans and Latinos comprise 29% of the U.S. population, they make up 57% of the U.S. prison population. This results in imprisonment rates for African-Americans and Hispanic adults that are 5.9 and 3.1 times higher than times the rate for white adults, respectively, and as far as higher levels in some states. Notably, these disparities exist for both the least and the most serious offenses. And they go into some of the reasons that they think that these things are going on. The racial disparities in the adult and juvenile justice system stem in part from policing, they talked about this earlier, and pretrial factors described earlier, and are compounded by discretionary decisions and sentencing policies that disadvantage people of color because of their race and higher rates of socioeconomic income. So what are these discretionary decisions? Biased use of discretion. Prosecutors are far more likely to charge people of color with crimes that carry heavier sentences than whites. Federal prosecutors, for example, are twice as likely to charge African Americans with offenses that carry a mandatory minimum sentence than similarly situated whites. State prosecutors are also more likely to charge black rather than similarly white defendants under habitual offender laws. Policies that disadvantage people of color. This is another underlined bullet. So these are different bullet points. So the first bullet point that I read you was biased use of discretion. In other words, prosecutors have their own discretion as to what charges they're going to file against a person. So let's just pause for a moment and just think about the Jesse Smollett situation. He was eventually charged after they found out that he was lying or believed that he was lying. He was eventually charged with about 16 felonies. A ridiculous amount of felonies. It really was just overkill. 16 felonies, which is probably part of the reason why the prosecuting attorney, who has discretion, said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to charge him with that. And so this is why more than likely the charges were dropped. But 16, this is the discretion that they have. I can tell you as a police officer, let's just say that a crime is committed. Let's just say someone burns down the house. A husband burns down the house because he and his wife are splitting up and he doesn't want his wife to get it. So in that particular situation, you can have a number of different charges that seem to overlap with one another. So he can be charged with arson, felony arson, depending on how the rules are written. You can be charged with breach of peace. You can be charged with fraud, insurance fraud, if he files for some type of insurance claim. So you can see that you can pile on these different charges all from one simple act of burning down a home. Same thing with the terrorist statutes. Someone who burns down a church. Okay, you did it. You, a white person, burns down a black church. So the prosecutors have all kind of discretion. Are you doing it simply because they're black? Okay, now you have federal or maybe even state intimidation and bias and prejudicial type of statutes that can be applied to the original charge of criminal mischief or reckless burning or something or arson or something along those lines. So all of these different types of charges are what constitutes the thought process of these prosecuting attorneys. And so this is what happened. So they have this prosecutorial discretion. Now, they get what they do with the discretion, according to this report and according to some other things that we'll get into, is that when they see a black face and they know it's a black defendant, then they'll up the charges. Or in some cases, they will actually refuse to lower the charges. We'll discuss that a little bit later. But judges and as well as prosecutors have the discretion to up charges, to lower charges, or to keep them as they are. So in Smollett's case, we can think about that for a moment. They could have taken those 16 felony counts and maybe reduced them to 5 felonies or some misdemeanor counts or something like that. So this is the type of flexibility that prosecutors have when they're deciding a case. Second bullet point, of this report that was submitted to the UN by the Sentencing Project. Policies that disadvantage people of color. Drug-free school zone laws mandate sentencing enhancement for people caught selling drugs in designated school zones. The expansive geographic range of these school zones, coupled with the high urban density, has disproportionately affected residents of urban areas, and particularly those in high poverty areas and people of color. So when you look at these drug laws, you can see that many times when there are school zones, particularly in highly dense populations, urban centers, those school zones, which also many times include daycares and other facilities like that, so if you're caught selling drugs in those particular school zones, if you know anything, if you look at a map of any particular school zone, you realize that many times that they overlap with housing projects and everything like that and where people live. So it's almost impossible if you live in an impoverished neighborhood, it's almost impossible for you not to live within that school zone. Everything's tightly knit together. And so your chances of committing a crime, number one, the crime of selling drugs in the first place, and number two, the chances that you are going to be doubly hit with selling in a school zone is going to severely impact you. And of course, now you bump it up to the first bullet point that we talked about in that discretion. And so now these crimes begin to get impact. There's a third bullet point, but I don't think it's really relevant to what I really want to get into today. I would encourage you all, this is all online, the Sentencing Project publications, sentencingproject.org publications. Look for UN report, racial disparity in sentencing, and you can read the whole report. It's not very long. Take you probably like 2 or 3 minutes. Then it goes on to talk about parole, which would be post-imprisonment, and then post-prison and collateral consequences, not being able to vote. You can't get certain jobs, can't get certain things, this, that, and the other. So read that report over. And it also has a bunch of recommendations, eliminate mandatory minimum sentences, reduce the use of cash bail, and things like that. Develop and implement training to reduce racial bias. So they have a number of recommendations. So we'll get into some of those things a little bit later. So let's go to the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI.org. There's a report that was written in 2017. Sentencing Commission finds black men receive longer sentences than white men for the same crime. Now, this particular blanket statement has been echoed throughout many communities for some time now. And I think that it's really unfair because it shows a particular bias. What it shows in what this report and what many reports that, of course, that I've been able to find is that this is all based on federal prison guidelines. So this is what's going on in the federal prison. We don't know what's going on in state prison. And at least this has not been fully backed up. Now, let me just back up and talk about what we just looked at, that report from the UN. When it talked about the first bullet point that I mentioned, once again, the end of that particular bullet point, it says the first bullet point about biased use of discretion, it says state prosecutors are also more likely to charge black rather than similarly white defendants under habitual offender laws. So what I was looking for, and I'm diligently looking for, and someone else can point this out to me, is where we have this comparison about what's going on in state prisons. Because most of what we're going to talk about with these sentencing guidelines, sentencing commissions, is the federal prisons. When this particular statement says state prosecutors are also more likely to charge black rather than white defendants under habitual offender laws, does have a footnote. But that footnote was from 1998. So it was from 1998. The footnote that they gave was from racial threat and sentencing of habitual offenders in the magazine, Criminology Magazine, that journal, written by Crawford, Churikos, and Kleck back in 1998. So that's pretty fairly dated, and in my estimation, in all honesty, quite unfair to say that. The report to the UN was written in 2018, to use something from 20 years earlier, 1998, is really kind of disingenuous in my opinion, but that's what they did. So the majority of this information that we're going to be talking about today is going to be from federal guidelines and statutes. Very, very difficult to figure out what's going on in the state sentencing guidelines. Now, let's just talk about the guidelines let's talk about where all this came from. In the late 1970s, this is where these different commissions about equal justice concerning prison sentencing came about. They really started to come to a head because obviously they recognized and saw that in many instances, because of lingering racism, black men and black people were getting longer sentences. So because of this information, many states began to adopt these different commissions. The first commission was adopted in 1987. I believe it was the state of Minnesota, and then not too long after that, the federal government instituted theirs, and today there's about 28 states who have one. When you look at this information, the states that have some type of state commission concerning their sentencing guidelines. It says 28. When you look at it and you Google all this kind of stuff, the state of Connecticut, my own home state, is not on that list. In 2011, they did actually establish their own commission. So, you know, this, you got to take this information that you get from the internet with a grain of salt. State of Connecticut does have one. You can go to their website or just pop in a Google search, State of Connecticut Sentencing Commission, and the website will come up. And matter of fact, I'm going to be probably reading from a little bit of the report a little bit later. You can download the report, so the PDF file, everything like that. So this back to this, what we were talking about, the Equal Justice Initiative. Sentencing Commission finds black men receive longer sentences for white men for the same crime. They talk about all this kind of stuff. This was written once again in 2017. Based on this particular report, now this particular report was written by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. This is where many of this comes from. We're going to be reading from that in a little bit. So the U.S. Sentencing Commission talked about, and they established some key findings based on their analysis of what was going on once again in the federal prison. Consistent with previous reports, this is from the Demographic Difference in Sentencing. This is published 2014, and they publish a report seemingly every year. The commission once again updated its analysis by examining cases in which offender was sentenced during the period of the following report. The new time period from 2011 through 2016 is referred to as the post-report period in this publication. Also, the commission has collected data from an additional variable, violence in the offender criminal history, that the commission had previously noted was missing from analysis, but that is might help explain some of the differences in sentencing in this work. So what they're doing is the commission is constantly reviewing a number of different factors into what goes behind a judge's decision in sentencing. So why did this judge come to the decision to do what he did? Well, number one, we already talked about is a lot of it has to do with the charges that are brought to him. If you understand anything about the criminal justice system, the police or the feds in this particular case, or whoever's bringing the charges, initiate the charges, bring them to the prosecutor. The prosecutor then has chances to up the charges, to keep the charges the same, or to downgrade the charges, make those felonies misdemeanors, or drop some charges, or they can even add charges based on what they see in the reports and the evidence and things like that. This is all these different guidelines. Once the prosecution and the defendants have made their case, as we know, the information goes to the judge, and the judge can then make a decision. Now, many of these commissions, as we're going to see and discuss a little bit later, are based on a different types of rubrics. Every state and the federal government has their own different type of rubric. They'll look at the education level of defendant. They will look at their past history, whether or not they're likely to reoffend and things like that. So these are the type of rubrics that they decide and that go into their decision-making process as they do it. So let's look at some of the key findings from this U.S. Sentencing Commission. Consistent with its previous reports, the commission found that sentence length continues to be associated with some demographic factors. In particular, after controlling for a wide variety of sentencing factors, the commission found, number one, that black male offenders continue to receive longer sentences than similarly white male offenders. Black male offenders received sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly white situated male offenders during the post-report period. That was from years 2012 to 2016, as they have a pre-period study. The difference in sentence length remained relatively unchanged compared to the post-Gaul period. Non-government sponsored departures and variances appear to contribute significantly to the difference in sentences length between black male and white male offenders. So this is point number two, non-government sponsored departures. In other words, this is where the prosecutorial decisions come in at. Black male offenders were 21.2% less likely than white male offenders to receive a non-government sponsored downward departure or variance during the post-report period. That all that kind of high technical talk really just means that the prosecutor, black male offenders were less likely than white male offenders for the non-sponsored downward departure. In other words, they saw a black face and they kept the charges the same. That's what that all that kind of talk is what it means. Furthermore, when black male offenders did receive a non-governmental sponsored departure or variance, they received sentences 16.8% longer than white male offenders who received a non-government sponsored departure or variance. In contrast, there was a 7.9% difference in sentence length between black male and white male offenders who received sentences with the applicable sentencing guidelines range, and there was no statistically significant difference in sentence length between black male and white male offenders who receive substantial yada yada yada. So in other words, they're getting more time in contrast to the white males. They looked at violence. Point number three, violence in an offender's criminal history does not appear to account for any demographic difference in sentence. Black male offenders receive sentences on average 20% longer than similarly white situated male offenders, accounting for violence in the offender's past in fiscal year 20, the only year for which this data is available. So when they only had data to look at history of violence in the last year, and that was 2016. So when they looked at 2016 and they looked at the history of violence, black males were still getting 20% longer and heftier sentences. Female offenders of all races received shorter sentences than white male offenders during the post-report period as they had for the prior 4 years. So, and this report can also be downloaded. So here are the key findings. Number one, once again, just to summarize from this U.S. Sentencing Commission, black male offenders continue to receive longer sentences in comparison to their white males. Taking all their backgrounds and everything in comparison for the years that they analyzed, black males were still getting longer sentences. Number two point is that in many of these cases, the prosecuting attorney either refused to bring down their charges, refused to lighten up their charges, and therefore also resulting in this difference in their sentencing. Number three, they looked at the violence defendants passed, and they can only find one particular year in which this information was available, 2016. Even they researched that, they still found that offender still had a longer sentence by up to about 20% in comparison. Female offenders of all races received shorter sentences than the white male offenders during the post report as they had for the four post years. An article from the Washington Post really just kind of echoes that. So once again, when you read these types of articles from, particularly from the Washington Post or from Vox, and they're talking about black men receive longer prison sentences, please understand that these are federal prison sentences. So we don't know what's going on in the state. At least I could not find right now. And I went to my collegiate library, typed in some information. I could not find it. So if someone out there has the information, please send it to me, and I'm going to continue to look for it. But I think it's very important to understand that this is federal stuff that's going on. So we need to also look at what's going on. So I want to talk about a little bit about why this is going on. So the U.S. Federal Sentencing Guidelines was established, like we said, and why this is particularly important is because this was prior to about 2005. The sentences, this is very important, in about 2005, the sentences from 1987, remember, because in 1987, 88 or so is when these guidelines really started to take hold, particularly for the federal government. So what happened? 2005, there was a case law, U.S. versus Booker, 543 U.S. 220, 2005. Now, in this particular case law, it was a case law about child sex and child sex abuse and things like that, or child abuse. So what happened was the U.S. Supreme Court said that sentencing guidelines were no longer mandatory, but they were just suggestions, essentially. So after 2005, because now judges, once again, federal judges were now freer to implement what they thought in their own particular guidelines, then you start to see these racial disparities start to creep in. So before, when they had these strict guidelines that they had to go by, there seemed to be some sort of parity across the board. 2005, this U.S. versus Booker case comes in. This U.S. Supreme Court says, no, these are just guidelines. You don't have to, every federal judge doesn't have to go by that. Use your best judgment and best wisdom. And next thing you know, you get these judges who are now handing out these longer prison sentences. They're handing them out because, once again, the prosecutors are bringing these charges. The prosecutors aren't lessening the charges, or they're increasing charges, what have you. And so now you get this situation once again. So let me just read to you a little bit about this. In 2003, Congress passed the PROTECT, which was an attempt to reassert the principles of consistency and fairness in federal sentencing policy, particularly in cases involving sexual exploitation of children. The USSC data, that's the Sentencing Commission, are troubling because they indicate that Congress's statutory goals are being undermined as a result of Booker. This is that case, right? After the Supreme Court's decisions in U.S. v. Blakely, 2004, and U.S. v. Booker, 2005, which converted the mandatory sentencing regime that had been in place since 1984 to an advisory one. Right, so these guidelines have been in place since 1984. Many observers became concerned about the possible emergence of three problematic trends. Number one, an increase in judge-made sentences imposed outside the ranges established by the sentencing guidelines. Number two, shorter sentences for certain types of offenses. And three, increased geographic and racial disparity in sentencing. So these, so once this thing happened in 2005, once the U.S. Supreme Court said you don't have to go by this, then all these things start to creep up and creep in. Based what I'm reading to you now is from the Justice Department of Justice. This is from May 15, 2016, U.S. DOJ. Based upon the most recent data released by the USSC, these post-Booker concerns are well-founded. The fairness, consistency, predictability, and accountability that were hallmarks of the federal sentencing guidelines and are a key objective of the Protect Act are in serious jeopardy. So much more of this can be read. Once again, this is another PDF that can be reached at justice.gov. Just type in U.S. v. Booker in the archives and it should come up. Another key point is that there's been a number of studies that indicate that black boys are viewed as older, less innocent than whites. Research found this is from American Psychological Association, May 6, 2014. Black boys viewed as older, less innocent than whites. If you listen to my podcast on implicit bias, I mentioned the particular studies. Once again, just check them out. And so why is this important? Why is this study? Because if you see people as less than, or you think that they're more than, that you see a black boy who's 10 years old and you think he's 20. In fact, we can go back to Tamir Rice, and I'll continue to talk about this because Tamir Rice was 12. But the officers, when questioned, said they, oh man, I didn't know he was 12. I thought he was 20. So there's this natural, for whatever reason, inclination to think that black boys are older than they are, that they're bigger than they are, that they're tougher than they are, and all this kind of stuff. As I was researching this, you know, you find out that the average white male in the United States is 5'8", and the average black male is slightly shorter than that, right? It's almost 5'7" or so, 5'7½" or so. Why are we continually viewed as older, larger? This is certainly problematic within our society. So American Psychological Association, 2014, black boys viewed as older, less innocent than white. That's stunning because you stand before a judge, he's going to see you as less innocent. You see him before police officers, prosecutors. As I mentioned in the implicit bias podcast, we talked about the teachers. We talked about all these kind of things. And if you're viewing us as less innocent, then you think that we're up to no good. Then all of these other rush of emotions flood the mind of people who think we are. And therefore, there's inherent tendency to want to put us away and put us in cages and things like that. I think that that's really worth exploring in its fullest, right? So this is based on the paper, The Interpersonal Relations and Group Processes, The Essence of Innocence, Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children, written by a number of four different authors back in 2014. Really good read if anybody wants to read it. Once again, The Essence of Innocence, Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children. And we know, just talks about the history of dehumanization. And it's a specific type of phenomenon, and not just choice, but it is a choice. It's the choice of dehumanizing people, and it's not just prejudice, it's dehumanizing. So the University of Michigan did a study in which they talked about all this information about how someone travels through federal prison system. And they talked about, so they went through the data collected by federal prosecutors, federal courts, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and they constructed a complete picture of each individual's path through the justice system. And this is from the University of Michigan Law School scholarships. And it is the racial disparity in federal criminal sentences. This is where much of the information comes from concerning the information that we use. They estimate that the size of racial disparity across the conditional sentencing contribution, we find that the majority of disparity between black and white sentences can be explained by differences in legally permitted characteristics, in particular the arrest offenses and the defendant's criminal history. Black arrestees are also disproportionately concentrated in federal districts that have higher sentences in general. Observing each case from arrest through to sentencing makes it possible to pinpoint where unexplained disparities emerge in the judicial process. We identify an important procedural mechanism that appears to give rise to the majority of otherwise unexplained disparity in sentences. How prosecutors initially choose to handle the case, in particular, the decision to bring charges carrying mandatory minimum sentences. Once again, this harkens back to what I was saying concerning the highly technical use of language about the government, non-government interventions and everything like that. So that's what they were talking. Are the prosecutors aware of the fact of what they're doing when they refuse to drop charges or when they increase charges and things like that? And these charges are brought obviously before federal judges. Again, let me just emphasize, these are federal judges doing this, right? We don't know exactly precisely what state judges are doing. We do know that a number of state there are a number of state commissions out there, at least 28, maybe 29, because Connecticut does have one. And it consists of, these commissions consist of prosecutors, judges, stakeholders from the community, police officers, all members of the Corrections Administration. So all of these are all working towards the same goal. So let's take one more look at this. The federal criminal code is vast, and the definitions of crime in the code often overlap, giving prosecutors a wide menu of charging options in a given case. Moreover, prosecutors must subjectively assess the strength of a case of evidence and choose how to characterize ambiguous facts. Let me read that sentence again. Moreover, prosecutors must subjectively assess the strength of evidence and choose how to characterize ambiguous facts. For instance, if a gun is found in a car that transported a defendant to a burglary, the prosecutor must decide whether to allege that the burglary legally qualified as a crime of violence under the U.S. Code, the gun qualified as a firearm, and that the defendant carried it during and in relation to the burglary, all of which are necessary to trigger five-year mandatory minimum sentences under the federal code, which would run consecutively to the burglary sentence. So you can see how if you just have a gun in the car and you're going to, in this hypothetical situation, if you have a gun in the car where you're going to commit a burglary, does that burglary now mean that it was a crime of violence because a gun was in the car? Does the prosecutor add that to the case? Does that burglary now become a robbery and intimidation and use of force? So this is all kind of things that the prosecutor and their office have to determine. And all of this based on determination. And once again, they see a black face and they don't want to ruin somebody's career, or they want to ruin somebody's career, or they see a white face and they don't want to ruin somebody's career, i.e. the case of that young boy, I believe he went to Stanford, who raped someone, only got 6 months in jail. Meanwhile, the kid from Ohio State raped someone. This is all allegedly, you know, and he got like 10 years. So this is two different states and two different possibly circumstances. But we can see how this disparity is going on. And it's just crazy that the judge in one particular case says, listen, I don't want to ruin this kid's life, essentially. And the other one, they threw the book at him. So this is the kind of disparity that's going on. And I think that it's unfair. And I think that everyone thinks that it's unfair. Let me just wrap this up because I don't want to go on with this. So I think that we've established that since the U.S. case of U.S. v. Booker, that there has been a decline in equality of the sentencing. And I think that really should be looked at. I think that some of the pundits and some of the academics who have been very cautious and skeptical of this have reason to be skeptical. And I think that more consistency needs to come in. I think we need to take a look at this disparity. I think maybe someone should do some research about the state lines of disparity. To the kudos to much of these states already have some type of disparity. You can go on your website and you can look at your state's website and what you can do. For example, you can go to National Center for State Courts. They have the state sentencing guidelines. They have their profiles and continuum, right? You can look at all the information. You can go to your local website or sentencing projects or state commissions and take a look and see if your state has one. I can read off the ones that are here: Alabama, Arkansas, Alaska, Delaware, DC, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Utah, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin. And I know that Connecticut has one, some type of commission. Right, so you can read about it in this particular PDF that I'm reading right here. It is from the National Center for State Courts, talking about their guidelines. And you can look and see each state has different guidelines, who sits on the guidelines for these particular state sentencing projects and their guidelines, these commission profiles and all that kind of stuff. And they can show you what you can read about what your particular state, if your state has one, and the different rubrics that they use in order to decide how much time an individual should get. And let me just wrap this up by saying, listen, when people say that the black people are automatically getting increased sentences, that's not always true. It is certainly true in federal cases. We don't know what's going on in state courts, but so we can only speculate with that. We do know the prosecutor's prosecutorial discretion to add charges, to drop charges, or to keep charges the same. We know that there are commissions that are going on. Think about the Jussie Smollett situation concerning the prosecutors. We know that judges, when they get these cases, in many cases, the federal courts have been proven that they are giving black people longer sentences, Hispanic people longer sentences. So this needs to change. What can we do? What we can do is you can see if your state has one, become involved in it, write to your legislature, let them know that you are interested in that, and ask them for a report. State of Connecticut does have a report from 2018. They released the annual report. This is Connecticut Sentencing Commission. You can read this at ctsentencingcommission.org. And they talk about a number of things that they had going on so you can read about all that. Stay involved with them. Stay involved with whatever your state commission has, is. Be involved. Write you to your local congressman. See what their stance is. Continue to follow it. Get involved. Stay involved. And see what you want to do and how you can go about these things. Listen, I hope this information was informative. This is just to kind of quell any type of uproar about what's going on. Give a little bit of information. It is a little bit of information. I realize that there's so much more we could talk about as far as these types of topics. But don't be overblown when someone says that, you know, it is what it is and the justice system is inherently racist. We talked about implicit bias. I think that implicit bias does raise its ugly head in these things. Since the Booker Report, I think that some biases have been able to creep back in. But I think that if we check those things through our legislature, through our letters that we write, I think that we can make a difference and bring back a lot of parity in our sentencing. That's it. So keep up with these different works. Write to the EJI. Come involved in any type of organization that you can. EJI is the Equal Justice Initiative. And join any local organization that you think can help to bring about fairness, impartiality, and our criminal justice system. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Let me know what I'm doing right. Let me know what I'm doing wrong. Visit my website. Hit me up if you want some help on your promotional test. HunterPoliceTraining.com. HunterPoliceConsulting@gmail.com. HunterPoliceConsulting@gmail.com. That's it. There's so much more to read, so much more we can do. I can spend, you know, hours and hours on this, but I don't want to. I just really just kind of wanted to wet your palate and get you thinking about these kind of things, and don't just take things blindly. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good day. Take care. Enjoy your week. Enjoy your life. Kiss your kids and hug your wife. That's it. Take care.